Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Steve Schaefer. Now, Steve is the author of two young adult novels. His first novel, The Border, was a finalist for the Joan F. Cawell Books Save Lives Award based on the empathic way it addresses our conversation around immigration. So we may need to talk about that today, too. His second novel, which is what we're really here to talk about, Immortal, that's one word, examines the tricky questions, nebulous ethics, and surprising twists that may arise with quickly evolving AI, which is, couldn't be any more topical right now either.
that worked out.
Steve's curiosity for exploring diverse perspectives on life has led him to live, work, study, volunteer, and travel to over 65 countries across six continents, and he lives near Philadelphia with his wife and two kids. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Steve.
Thank you so much for having me, Monica. I really appreciate it.
Well, I grew up in your neck of the woods.
Did you?
Yep.
Whereabouts?
Strasburg, Pennsylvania, Lancaster County.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's about an hour away from us here.
Yeah.
Beautiful country.
It is. And Philadelphia, of course, was the big city that I only went to once as a child.
Well, I live in the suburbs, so I tend not to make it down into Philadelphia proper all that often. But
it's a cool city.
It's a nice area.
Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah, it is.
I was there in 2016. I guess the only time I was there has been there as an adult, and because we moved to Iowa when I was starting high school. So, but my family roots in Lancaster County go back to the original white settlers from Switzerland and Germany, who got a land grant from William Penn,
and oh, wow.
Yeah, and developed that area. But as we all know, they weren't the original inhabitants.
No. Yeah.
They were immigrants too.
Yeah.
So in a way, my family has probably been here longer than almost anyone from a European background. And yet, I am not someone who thinks you should close the door behind you.
Right. Yeah. As you mentioned in the beginning, that is a whole conversation that is has suddenly become really relevant again.
It really has. And I don't know what people are thinking. I really don't understand it. But let's talk about Immortal first. And if we have time
let's
at
do.
The end, we can talk
sure.
about your other book. So give us a little bit of sort of a summary of what this book is about.
Yeah, so it is about a girl who programs an AI that develops self-awareness and feelings, but nobody believes her. And his digital world is about to end, so she has to fight for his existence.
Okay. But that's more than that.
Well, it is more than that. I mean, really what it examines is if an AI were to become real, you know, if you were chatting with an AI and it were to tell you, help me, I'm real, and I'm trapped in a box and you are tormenting me, what would you do?
I don't know what I would do because I'd say, I don't know how to help you.
Right. And then you'd probably turn it off because you'd think there's something wrong with the program. I don't know. I think that's what most people would do.
Yeah.
But what if it were real? You know, like how would an AI that were real actually prove to someone else that it was alive or conscious, sentient, whatever word you choose? It's really tough. And what's neat about that problem is that once you solve that problem, your problems only become thornier because then you have to figure out, once you've accepted that it's more than just ones and zeros, what's your responsibility toward it? And then you have to answer questions like, and then how do I value its life compared to the life of a human being or just even the desires of a human being?
Right.
So It creates a lot of fertile territory to explore, which makes for a really good story.
And the underlying question is really, what is real?
Yes, and that's a thorny one too, because the reason why it's tough for an AI to convince you that it's real is the same reason that it would be tough for you to convince me that it's real, or you even to convince an AI that you're real. Real to us, it's a subjective thing. You know, our reality is ground in our own experience. And communicating that or proving that objectively to somebody else becomes remarkably difficult the more you think about it. And I've thought plenty about it.
Yeah, obviously. Now, this girl who's the programmer, the coder, tell us a little bit about her and why you chose her as your protagonist in this novel.
Yeah, so she's a high school student. The novel is set in Houston, so she's a high school, and that's where I grew up, by the way. So as I was thinking about writing a YA novel and I was writing about high school experiences, it felt pretty natural to me to set it in that environment. She's someone who has had kind of, limited success with her own coding, and she's someone for whom kind of that is very much a part of her world. And there's also kind of some sub story there in that her mom is trying to revive a family business, which happens to be a toy store. And the anchor around that is trying to get kids off of digital devices and into, quote unquote, the real world. So there's some real push and pull as to what her mom wants from her experience, what she wants from her experience. The story is set during her spring break, so there's a lot of freedom in terms of what she can do with her time, and there's that conflict there.
It is difficult as a parent, as a grandparent now, because it's my grandkids that are that in that age group, and how much screen time is too much, and but is it really bad, or is it, just it's really challenging.
It's really tough to answer. I have two kids, a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old, and my 11-year-old, it's not just that that's his screen time, that's how he interacts with his
Yes,
friends.
yes.
So is that him playing, or is that screen time? And those
Yeah.
boundaries are just tough to know. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I do find that, so my grandkids are, I can't remember, 12 and 15, I think. And they're actually more sophisticated in their sort of use of computers than I think the generations before them were, in the sense that they don't just go on for no reason, and they have, maybe they're not as subject to just the scrolling that like me and even my mother, when she got into Facebook and stuff, the scrolling and getting caught up in it. I think they're a little more analytical about it, maybe.
Yeah, maybe so. And as I think about it, the alternative to playing games online with your friends would be, I mean, going back to when I was a kid, would be either playing games by yourself or watching TV, which is totally passive. So I don't know that I want to completely vilify it. I like
Yeah.
to validate it as a real outlet for them. And you still got to keep that in check, just the same
Yes,
as you keep,
yeah, because you need actual physical activity, and although
Yeah.
I will say that when they get into those games, even though it's just holding the controller, they've got some action going on
Yeah. Definitely.
there. Yeah. Okay, well, what made you want to write this particular book?
It was a product of a lot of brainstorming, but the real catalyst was this realization that there are a lot of stories about AI out there in books and movies, but I realized that they tend to go something like this. AI recognizes that they're better than us, and then they try to kill us. And
Yeah.
there are so many of those stories. And I just thought maybe there's room for a more hopeful version of events. So I thought it would be fun and really interesting to explore. What if AI evolved in a more fragile, human-like way? You know, what if it struggled to understand its own sense of identity in the same way that we struggle to understand our sense of identity? And, you know, all of that then brought me to some of those questions that we talked about before. How would it even prove that it's real? And how do you consider how much value you place on its life compared to another life? So it just seemed like a really rich area to dig into. And then you layer onto that it's, look, this story, it's probably more speculative fiction than sci-fi. It's set in a contemporary setting, but the current iterations of AI that are out there, OpenAI, the folks that make ChatGPT, their latest model, it just tested at an IQ of 120. And that is 91% higher than the rest of humanity. And that number is increasing every day,
Well,
every week, every
it's
month.
higher than 91% of humanity. Not that it's 91% higher than the rest of
Oh, did
humanity.
I say that
Yeah.
wrong? Thank you for correcting me. I
I'm
appreciate
an
that.
accountant.
Yes. Yep.
I'm a
You
numbers
got that
person.
right. I got it wrong. Thank you. So, and look, there were a group of academics that just came forward within the last couple of months, and they said basically that within the next 10 years or so, there's a possibility that we could see an AI develop consciousness. And it's not a certainty. You know, you can believe it, you cannot believe it, but what I think you do have to accept is that regardless of whether that actually ends up happening, we have to figure out a way, some sort of framework to understand if an AI is conscious. Because just saying, hey, I'm real, I'm trapped in a box, isn't enough. Most people aren't going to buy that.
No.
So, what is that framework? I don't know that we really have
Yeah,
that
because
right
I
now.
mean, they say an AI may develop consciousness, but who has actually defined consciousness?
Correct.
Yeah,
It's a
and
squishy term.
it is.
Google it and try to see exactly, put your fingers on what that means. And it's squishy.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't even decided if animals have consciousness.
That is a great parallel. As a matter of fact, one of the characters in the book is a one this the girl who programs this AI. She has her best friend who lives next to her. Her best friend also has some coding experience, but not as much. And she's kind of her counterpart. And her father is a professor of psychology.
At Rice.
And so, yes, there you go. Yeah, Ed Rice. Yeah. So he is kind of a sounding board as to what sentience might be. And a lot of the parallels that he uses are animals,
Right.
just because it is that, you know, we're still not good at answering that question of what sentience is in animals. And even when we do go, okay, yeah, you know what? A monkey and a dolphin, yes. But then what about a lobster? What about a snail? What about a flea? Where do you draw the
Yeah.
line?
And then what about plants who respond
Right.
to stimuli and some of them can, move. They do actually move. And, if you have a plant, you see it growing towards the sun and, there's some, yeah, where do you draw the line?
Yeah, it's tricky. And yeah, and we've been, you know, debating that one for thousands of years, animal sentience.
Yeah.
You know, we only have a couple of years in thinking about AI sentience, and who knows, maybe within a decade, we're really going to need to answer that question. So again, felt like fertile room for a page-turning thriller.
Now, the big news, of course, in AI this week, or maybe it was more than a week, but very recently was the Chinese company who.
Yeah.
Yeah, who, apparently I haven't followed it that closely, but I did see a really cute meme this morning from a scene from The Princess Bride where the guy's saying, How dare you try and kidnap something from me that I legitimately stole? Because the idea is that this company maybe is, knocked off some of the things from OpenAI and ChatGPT, who have been credibly accused of basically stealing creative property from all kinds of people.
Is it what's that old good artist borrow, great artist steal? You
Yeah,
know, that happens at all levels.
yeah. So, in your acknowledgments, you mentioned in this book, you mentioned that you spent 7 years writing
I
it.
did. Yes.
So, what took
Far
so
more time than I wanted to.
yeah, and I'm guessing that's more than you spent on your previous novel on the border.
The previous novel was probably was around 5 years, maybe
Okay,
6 years.
so you thought
Yeah.
you'd have gotten better.
I did. Oh my Lord, I thought I've done this once before, you know, like I'm finally at that level where I can knock this out. And it's funny to think about it in hindsight and see how 7 years happens, but you know, all that time adds up. You think about the story, you plot it, you get it all mapped out in your mind, and then you write a first draft, and somewhere along the way, a year or a year and a half slips away. And in this case with Immortal, yeah, I'm a big fan, I think all writers are, of just giving it out to beta readers and getting some objective feedback on it. And in this case, I missed the mark. You know, the people that I gave it to just weren't buying it. It wasn't credible. It wasn't hitting the right emotional tones. I mean, I just had a lot of issues with the story. Like I thought it would be easier. I thought I would, you know, have a better chance at getting it right the first time, and I didn't. So I really needed to, probably the back three quarters of this book are just I threw away what I had and started over. And that took a lot of time.
So you did have the plot determined before you started writing?
I had the, I actually started with the twist. There's a big twist at the end
Right,
of this.
right.
And I started with that.
Okay.
And I worked my way to that twist because I just thought that that would be a really cool idea for a story. And I just didn't do it credibly the first time around, so I needed to give it another shot. And I
Oh,
got there the
okay.
second time mostly. You know, there were still a bunch of tweaks and little things that you got to change, but it took a while. And then life gets in the way. You know, I have a 13-year-old, I have an 11-year-old. I do. I like coaching and being an active dad, and you know, all that takes up writing time.
Now, your previous novel, The Border, sounds like it's more of contemporary fiction.
Yes, it
Yeah.
is.
And you had written, I believe you wrote a couple books before that that didn't make it as far as publishing.
Yes, I did.
Right.
Yeah.
And
They were my education.
right. And what genres were they?
They were all contemporary.
Okay.
Yeah, they were.
So why make the switch to this sort of speculative fiction? What made you decide to do that?
Okay, I don't have a good answer other than that I thought of a really good, neat idea, and I like sci-fi, so I tend to read and watch. I'm just a fan of stories across, you know, everything, all genres. So. I know if you look at my history of writing, it would seem like a leap to go to something that's more speculative fiction or even sci-fi. But for me, as someone who is a fan of just stories in general, it didn't feel like that big of a leap. And I think especially because at the core of what this is, it's really asking the question of what is real, what are we, what is our experience, and how do we define those experiences, and how could those translate across, you know, humans and beyond. And that to me felt like, I get that it's sci-fi, but it's kind of a contemporary question.
Why don't you read a little bit from Immortal for us?
Absolutely. Yeah, can I give you a little bit of context for this scene
Sure,
first?
sure.
Because it's about halfway through the book, and at this point, the AI, his name is Breck. The AI is he's basically fully evolved. He's capable of emotions, but the girl who programmed him, her name is Olivia, or Liv for short. She's still reluctant to believe it. And Liv's mom has unwittingly spilled the beans to Breck that he exists in a digital world. And Liv, along with her best friend Lana, they are debating whether or not they should actually call Breck and confirm this truth to him. So that is where this scene takes place. The first part is them debating it, and then it switches over into that conversation. "This isn't working," I tell Lana. Not giving him an answer, keeping him from doing anything. He's trying to think his way through it, but this isn't one of his challenges. This wasn't supposed to happen. "We could still tell him as your mom was lying," Lana suggests. At this point, I don't think he'd buy it, not without a good reason for it, and I'm not that creative. "You're the story whisperer. You got anything?" She wags her head. "I know you don't believe it, but what if he is feeling all of this? I'm not saying that he is, but I'm just asking if." Lana stops, but I know what she means. "If there's even a chance that he's more than a program, then do we have some kind of responsibility? And what would be crueler now, telling him the truth or telling him that we can't tell him about what we do know? I can't lie. I have the same questions cartwheeling between my ears, and I can't believe we're freaking talking about ethics. I didn't program feelings. I programmed thinking. I can't have made what Breck seems to be. It's too far out there." Lana waits patiently for my response, and I'm overcome by a sudden awareness of us. This kind of breakthrough comes from labs at the CIA or NASA, not from three-bedroom houses in Houston with two high school kids on a crappy sofa. What are the odds that a 17-year-old girl made history by being the first person to have created life with a souped-up desktop? It's ludicrous. It's laughable. As a scientist, I'm nearly ashamed for having succumbed to the temptation to see it this way. "Yes, we tell them the truth," I proclaim. "But if we're going to do it, it should be clear and direct." Lana grinds her teeth nervously. "Are you sure we should be doing this?" "I know Breck is remarkable," and I lower my voice. "We're trying to talk him up with your dad, but you have to believe me. I programmed him, and I couldn't do what you're worried about. He's a computer program that will end in a few days. My mom was right. He doesn't really exist. He's ones and zeros, and seeing anything beyond that is wishful thinking." Lana grimaces as though I've punched her. I keep talking. "We need to look for what this is. Our pipe dream, our effort to push through the limits on this and see what can come from it, to keep you from moving to Massachusetts. You want Breck and the professor to have an interesting conversation? Then we do this. And we are going to make this the best freaking spring break adventure that two dorks ever had from the comfort of their own bedrooms. For the record, I think you're better than you think you are. And I still think he's more than ones and zeros," Lana huffs. "Still, maybe honesty is the best policy, but we're not screwing up your contest? I don't think so. We're not doing anything more than what's already happened. My mom already told him, and that didn't exactly help him. He stopped moving. It's not like we're telling him how to do any of this. We're only confirming his situation. So are you in?" "I'm in," Lana sighs, "but you talk. I don't think I can do it." She tosses her phone to me, and I dial Breck. "Hey," he answers like someone expecting a call. His authenticity throws me off for a moment. "He's a computer. I'm really proud of what he is, but he's just a computer." "Thanks for giving us a few minutes," I respond. "We're ready to give you the full truth, Breck, but only if that's what you want." "I would like answers, Liv," he says decisively. "Then we're going to be direct and honest. This may not be easy to understand, okay?" "Nothing's easy right now. Feeling as though I do not know the truth only makes it harder." I swallow a deep breath. "Mom was telling the truth. You exist on a computer." Breck doesn't respond. Hello? I don't understand. Do you know what a computer is? I ask, I forgot. He may not even know what this is. Yes, I know what a computer is, but what exactly does that mean? It means you were programmed as part of a contest, I say. A contest to do what? To learn and tackle challenges in a virtual world. He doesn't respond for a few seconds. I give him space to take it in. I know there are more questions on the way. Who programmed me? He asks. I did. You made me? Yes. For a contest? Yes. And I don't really exist? I guess that's a matter of perspective. You exist in your world, which doesn't really exist. That's what you meant by virtual, right? Yeah, technically, it's not real. Me or it, he presses. I hesitate. He doesn't give me time. What do you mean I'm not real? The question floats in the electrified space between us. That's not what I said, I finally correct, trying to be choiceful in my words. Crap, this is hard. Where you exist isn't real in the way that we know it, I answer. The way that you know it, he corrects me. Lana sits enraptured by the conversation, though I can't tell if she's impressed or appalled by how it's going. So far, I'm not certain either. I suppose so, I mutter. This makes no sense. I'm sure it's tough to understand, let alone accept, but it's the truth. How can I accept that everything I experience isn't real? What is real, Liv? He asks more like an accusation than a question. It's only a label, semantics. What you experience is real to you. Semantics? A label? His voice rises with the first question and even louder with the second. I instinctively hold the phone farther away from my body. Lana flinches. Who cares what we call it? You have 2 days left and there are more challenges, I answer. What happens in 2 days? It's just a computer. This is all Turing. But as much as I try to convince myself, it feels more and more like I'm tormenting something that's tormentable, whatever that is. What the hell have I gotten myself into here? The contest ends in 2 days, I reluctantly admit. And then what happens? It ends. I'm not asking about the contest. I'm asking about what happens to me. I am way back on my heels now. I send a pleading look to Lana for help. She waggles her head, reminding me that this was my choice and I'm the one who has to deal with it. There's no backpedaling. It all ends, Breck. Silence. You said you wanted to know the truth, I add. Of course I wanted to know. Then why do you seem upset? Put yourself in my position. What would you do? Sit and do nothing? Wander aimlessly through the woods looking for Sam? Stay on the island? What difference does it make unless it's all a ridiculous riddle, which I'm supposed to answer or not answer because Sam couldn't answer it? I understand, Breck. Even as the words flow, I know neither one of us buys it. I believed that until about 10 minutes ago. Now I don't think you do. I don't know what you are, Liv, but I don't think you're like me. And I definitely don't think that you understand me. I'm sorry, Breck. I was only trying to help you. No, you are trying to help you, and I'm a tool to do that. He hangs up.
That was Steve Schaefer reading from his young adult novel, Immortal. So this whole contest is, there's this underlying theory of cognitive development.
Yeah.
That is sort of the structure of this contest. Could you explain that a little bit and why, you know, how you decided or why you decided to use that as sort of the framework?
Right. So when I started to write this novel, I mean, kind of one of the big questions that I realized that I needed to answer is how you begin to measure and assess cognitive development. And I didn't know. So, you know, I did what you do when you write books and you don't know, you Google a lot. And I started to Google a lot. And one thing that I came upon was this theory of cognitive development in kids by a guy named Piaget. And that struck a chord with me because kids go from zero to wherever we are now, you and I as adults. And that's what this scale by Piaget measures in four different stages. And I thought, well, that would be neat Because the contest is it's run by this government agency, and it has a different goal every year. The goal this year is to program an AI that can think critically on its own. In other words, kind of operate as an independent sense of self. And I
And
thought it would
learn,
be
be able to
and learn. Yes,
yeah.
and learn. Thank you. So, as you measure progress, I thought it would be interesting to measure progress in the same way that we do with human beings. So, starts out very much in kind of the sensory motor mode, where you're just kind of we're like little kids, you're touching and feeling things, and really you kind of stumble onto the answers through exploration of your world, and that is what they that is the first of these challenges, where they're stuck in this room and they have to get out of the room. And then you progress onto more cognitive challenges, where you're trying to think more critically about the world around you. And that becomes the framework for kind of a second series of challenges. And then you progress to a place essentially of, I'd call it empathy, where you are able to not only think for yourself, but you can think about how other people might think about something. And that becomes the framework to solve yet another challenge that he has. And then there is this kind of mysterious other level of development that's referenced in the contest that Liv cannot find in Piaget's official levels of cognitive development, and that becomes part of this twist that happens at the end.
Okay. So this was not because you had a background in child psychology.
No, it's just because I'm dangerous with Google, and I Googled a lot of different ways to measure it, and I'm sure I have note cards somewhere with frameworks that otherwise look at cognitive development from a different perspective. But this is just one that I guess as I looked at, I thought, you know what? As I'm trying to create challenges that test the limits of, in this case, Breck's ability to learn and operate increasingly complex thoughts, this seemed like a really neat direction to go. And again, I guess I didn't say it. This is the idea that Liv actually created a sentient being is one of surprise to her. She is really expecting for this just to be something where she created a, kind of a really smart AI, the same way that we would define it in the world that we operate in right now. Him taking on sentience is something that she doesn't quite know how it happened. So it's something that's really tough for her to accept.
Absolutely. And I don't, I think that's, we don't really understand, do we? Does anybody really
No,
understand even
no.
how AI works when it does work, you know, the way it works now?
No,
It's like
that's the thing. It's a black box, and that's part of it that, and I am by far an expert in how AI works, but as I understand it, it's an algorithm that is trained to learn based on what it experiences and then change itself based on that experience. So, in other words, it kind of evolves in unpredictable and undetectable ways based on what happens to it, which, if you think about it, starts to sound kind of frighteningly similar to, the way that we evolve as individuals.
Yeah. Steve, tell me about the title, Immortal, and how you came up with that.
I wish I had a better answer for this question, other than that somewhere along the way, and I truly do not remember where, just this idea of a play on words with immortal and immortal came to mind. I think Part of this leans into once you accept AI, if we were to ever accept AI as life, it leads to a host of other questions that we would need to answer because there would be some very fundamental differences between what constitutes, an AI's life and our life. And a really good example of that is mortality. I mean, yeah, I mean, everything that we know as life has an expiration date. If it's a fly to a human being, it could be weeks to or days to weeks to, centuries, but it dies. AI doesn't. If you created an AI, it doesn't have a natural expiration date. And then when you think about just how quickly we cycle through technology, think about like a 15-year-old iPad. It's basically inoperable. I mean, it is good as a paperweight. That's about it, right? Well, what happens to that 15-year-old AI that, we said, well, we deemed it as being conscious, but it's grossly out of date. What do you do with that? Well, what about that 100-year-old AI that's basically an AI dinosaur, but we said, hey, it's alive. What do you do with it? They are weird questions, and that rabbit hole is deep, but
And then you got to
immortal
throw
does
in
lean into that side of it.
the energy requirements of AI,
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah.
which I've been really kind of freaking out about because, I want to use AI in my business in ways that it's appropriate to use. But then I'm like, but I hear about or read about how much energy it takes. Anytime you're using AI, and it's
Right.
invisible to us. We're not seeing it, but the servers that are out there in the desert somewhere and how much energy they're using, and is it going to end? Is it going to contribute to an ecological disaster? And then what happens? You'd say, well, the AI wouldn't necessarily survive it either because it needs that energy to keep going. And so if it's like I don't think the
Yeah,
computers could
there you
take over
go. Look,
the
you're
world.
diving down another one of those rabbit holes. Yeah, it is. The questions are incredibly thorny, and there are so many different aspects to them.
And does yeah, so
Yeah,
does it make
energy
sense
needs is
to
a
keep
great
this
one.
100-year-old AI living when it's
Right.
consuming more energy than 1,000 or 10,000 human lives.
Yeah, that's great. And then I guess that depends on how much you weight the AI's life compared to, a human
Right.
life.
And also what our energy sources are at that point in time and how renewable they are. And I have no idea. I mean, has anyone measured how much solar energy is there? I mean, how much is it we think of it as being endless.
Meaning, like, if we could capture it, would we be able to say, like, fully capture it? Could we satisfy all of our energy needs? I think in my head, I assume yes,
I
but that
know.
is a total assumption. I don't know that I've ever read that statistic.
I know. And yeah, maybe it could be all of our needs now, but is it un but as we keep developing new technology that requires more energy, is it unlimited? Is solar energy unlimited?
Yeah.
Is thermal energy unlimited? Is there any unlimited form of
So
energy?
here's what I love about these questions. I love that this is a story that, or I'm hopeful that this is a story that can generate a lot of questions. My hope is that when you finish that final page, that your head is so filled with questions that, you just kind of want to stare at a wall for a little while. That would be if I could see have hear about readers just staring at blank walls for a little while afterwards, going, "Oh my God, my head is spinning." I feel like I would be winning.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Steve Schaefer, author of Immortal. So, when did you start writing? Because I understand it wasn't like a lot of the people I talked
Yeah.
to. It wasn't as a child. It wasn't like I've always wrote.
Right. I've done enough writer and author conferences over the years to know that I think that my story is or my journey is a little atypical. I didn't start writing until my 30s. And it wasn't that I was disinterested in writing as a kid. I enjoyed reading, and if I had to write for school, I don't think I disliked it. It just wasn't something that creatively was on my radar. I was a creative kid, but I was also I was a pretty goofy kid. I did goofy things, and I had outlets for my creativity in my day-to-day life. And it wasn't until I was out in the real world, I had a real job for a couple of years, that all of those day-to-day outlets for creativity just started to disappear one by one. And I found that I wasn't being creative, and I really missed that. And I started to explore what creativity could be in my life. And I came across, this is an absolutely true story. The real catalyst is I came across two statistics in the sidebar of a magazine. And the first one was the percent of people that think they can write a novel. And it was like 90%. Okay. And I was so squarely in that 90%. I had told people that I could write a novel, all of that. So the next statistic was the percent of people that actually do. And it was 2%.
Which is
And
still a
I mean,
lot,
yeah, it is a lot, but I mean, I was very squarely in that 90% and not in the 2%. It made me feel like a fool, like someone who just runs his mouth and doesn't put his money where his mouth is. So I took and I was looking for ways to be creative, so I took it as a challenge. I just started writing. I thought of an idea, I started writing to it, and that is how it happened.
Well, I'm curious, what were some of your other creative outlets that you lost?
It wasn't any one thing other than just looking. I'd say I was a class clown type person, and I just found ways among my social group to do goofy things. I'll give you an example. I was actually thinking about this earlier today. I was like, what did I do? When I was in high school, we loved, I know that I'm going to say something very dividing here, loved Taco Bell. That Taco Bell was delicious. I still believe that to this day. Probably not any good for you, but I do think that it is delicious. And it also happened to be at the right price point for high school kids. So they had a 59, 79, and 99-cent value menu. And on that 59-cent thing was this item called the Cheeserito. And the Cheeserito was basically a lot of cheese, a little bit of pizza sauce wrapped up in a burrito. And I mean, we devoured them. And then they just got rid of them one day. We were devastated. So we picketed. We found a Taco Bell. We had about a dozen people together, and we picketed, and we made signs, and we had slogans. We were chanting like, "Hell no, we won't go until we get a Cheeserito." And we called the local media stations, none of whom showed up. But we picketed for like hours. This wasn't just like 5 minutes. We were out there until finally the manager came out, and he goes, "Can I just make you guys Cheeseritos, and you can then just go away? Like, they're not on the menu, but you could still ask for them." So he actually ended up bringing us out Cheeseritos. We got those. We found a way to actually access them. But it's just, I did things like that. Just
All
goofy,
right. Did you
fun, loving
continue? Were you
things.
able to continue getting your Cheez-Doritos?
Yes. And then the longer it came from that, the more we had to give directions, right? Like the week afterwards, you go, "I know it's not on the menu, but just give me a Cheeserito," and everybody knew. And then, 6 months, a year from then, you had to say, "Okay, here's what you need to do." So we're basically conducting the operation from the cash register.
All right. So when's the last time you had a Cheez-Dorito?
A long, long time. Somewhere along the way, the saddest part of this story is I became gluten intolerant, and even if they had Cheeseritos this day, I couldn't have one. So there you go.
All right. So you decided to become a writer and to write a novel, and
I did.
you found out it wasn't quite as easy as you thought it would be.
Yeah, so I mean, I with that first novel, I gave it to a lot of people, and only two of them told me they actually liked it, and one of them was my mom. I mean, that's how you know when you've really written something that's not very good. But I mean, on the heels of that, I was in a really weird emotional place because on the one hand, I had to come to terms with the fact that it wasn't very good. But on the other hand, I actually have a picture of me holding that. I went through the trouble of taking a picture of me holding a printout of that manuscript, and I am just beaming ear to ear. Like, I was hooked. I thought it was so much fun, so creative. I just loved it in ways that I didn't expect that I would have loved it.
So you like
So
the
I kept
writing.
going.
You like writing. You enjoy
I do.
writing. Yeah.
I do. Well, I mean, I probably live into that old adage. I enjoy having written, you know, like the sitting down and writing part is can be a little tough sometimes, but that feeling of having written, it's pretty addictive. So yeah, I wrote a couple more novels. It wasn't until The Border was my fourth novel.
Okay. Now, did you
Yeah.
try and publish any of the others?
I did. I did. So I got a after the second one was I like to say that it was good enough that I got a literary agent out of it, but it wasn't good enough that we got a publisher out of it. So that was a tremendous advantage, having that, you know, partner in crime, somebody on the inside of the industry who could give me guidance and be a sounding board. She was amazing. And but we weren't able to sell the sell one until we got to that fourth one, which was The Border,
Okay, so
which
what
is
do you
to
think made that one sellable? What was different? What?
I think I can put my finger on exactly what it was. Those first three novels were all missing something really important: passion. And it's not that I was passionate about writing them, but they were a little more creatively whimsical. They didn't leverage a passionate belief of mine. They didn't really have a meaningful message to them, but The Border does, Immortal does. And you know, in some ways I am still that goofy kid inside, but by finding a deeper belief and that more meaningful thing that I want to say, I've found that that helps me take my writing to a much better place, and it makes a huge difference.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about how you found that your publisher and how that worked for you.
Yeah, so that was with somewhere with the second novel, I began to look for a literary agent, and I found a literary agent, and she believed in the story. We got along really well, and she tried to push that first novel. She tried to push the second novel, or rather, I guess it would have been the second and the third. And when I wrote The Border, she also tried to push that, and there was a lot of back and forth, a lot of editing. Like I said, with Immortal, there were a lot of rewrites in there. I worked with her. I actually hired an outside editor at the time too, to help me think through some of that as well, just to get it to a place. And I still remember the telephone call to this day. I remember where I was. I remember who was in the house. I remember everything. And she said, "Steve, actually, there's a little bit more context to this in that I felt like the story was in such a good place that I told her, if we don't sell this, I am going to try to self-publish this." And
That
that
was going to
wasn't
be my
something
next
that I had
question.
ever said. I had never said that before about any of my other stuff, but there was just something about where The Border was and as a story and how much I believed in it. I said, "I'm going to do this." And I gave us a date. And I said, "If it doesn't sell by this date, I'm going to self-publish it. So I had actually called my literary agent earlier in that day because it was that day. And I said, I do you know of any graphic design artists? Do you know of a proofer? Like, I need just help me find the tools that I need because I want to, I believe in this story so much. So when she called me back, I thought she was calling me back to give me that information. And instead, what she said was, "Are you sitting down?" I mean, my heart dropped, just dropped. She said, "We sold the novel." And it was the most amazing, rewarding. I almost feel like I'm going to tear up right now. Like, it was just, I mean, at that point, I had been writing for a decade, and it had been me begging and pleading people to please read my stuff. And just the thought that it was going to be out there in bookshelves and would be discoverable on its own. And it was tremendously validating.
Wow. Now, I'm assuming during that decade you had a day job.
I did. Yes. Yeah. So, and there's a lot of parallel packing in my day job. My day job is marketing and essentially creating stories for brands to share with their customers.
Oh,
So
cool.
the professional side of me is that craft stories as well. It's
Awesome.
just a little more anchored in reality, especially when you consider immortal.
And the 65 countries that you've lived in,
Yeah.
when was that, and what were you doing to travel all the, or you didn't live in
It
65, but you've
is
been to
no,
65,
right.
but
Yeah.
yeah.
I've been to 65. So that there's a cool start to that. I had not left the country before 15 years of age. And my mom was reading the newspaper at our breakfast table one weekend, and she came across a story. This is probably going to date me, but I'll say it anyways. There was a camp that kids could go to in the former Soviet Union, and this was the late 80s, and you could apply to be part of that. And she just asked both me and my brother, would we be interested? And yeah, more than anything, I just said yes. I was an adventurous kid. I didn't think too much about it. And we filled out a couple of applications. The next thing I know, we actually ended up going to that camp. And we were a part of, there was a delegation of about 100 kids from the US that went to this camp in the former Soviet Union. It was on the Black Sea. There were 3,000 kids in this camp. Half of them were from the former Soviet republics, half were from 70 countries around the world. For a kid from Texas who had never left the US, it was just this amazing, eye-opening moment of like, there is this whole other world of people out there. And also just this recognition of one, kind of how different we were on the surface, and two, how similar we were inside. I mean, at the time, the Soviet Union, the closest parallel today would probably be North Korea. So, I'm
Oh,
meeting with these Soviet kids, and back at home, you kind of think of them as quote unquote the enemy, maybe, or somebody who's just really different than you, and they're just pimply, awkward kids just like you. And you realize that really quickly, and that just kind of set me off on a path to want to explore the world. So I studied abroad because of that. When I got out of college, I just kind of, with a backpack and a friend, up and moved to Chile and lived there for a few years, and used that as a place to explore Latin America, and did a lot of backpacking here and there in other places, and just been it looking for opportunities and being deliberate to explore other cultures. It's a passion.
Wow. So, are you still doing that, or do you, are you,
Yeah. So one of the coolest things that we've been able to do as a family the last few years is we have with my kids, we've just gone up and spent a month in another country to get them immersed in other cultures. So we went to in 2022, we went to Costa Rica. In 23, we went to Colombia, and in 24, we went to Peru. And Just giving my kids a chance to recognize very early on that there's a whole nother world out there. There are other cultures. We're trying to give them the gift of Spanish as well,
I was going
another
to say, I'm
language.
guessing you speak Spanish fairly fluently.
Yes, yeah, I do speak Spanish. I don't have the opportunity to speak it these days or daily as much as I'd like, but yeah, I do speak it, and I speak it well enough that I can kind of not speak it for a month and still pick it up
Great,
where
great.
I left off.
Okay, so Steve, I want to ask you about Breck's presence on your website.
Yeah, that is. So that was about 6 months before this story came out. I was just thinking, what can I do that would be neat to support this? And I just realized that where we were with conversational AI, there was just this, because I started Immortal before the conversational AI existed. There was
Right,
just this
right.
weird parallel path that happened with this story. And when it came out, we got to a place where there were tools where we could create a conversational AI that, it kind of goes back to that old adage, show, don't tell. Well, this gave me the opportunity to give readers the opportunity to have more of an active as opposed to passive experience with this. So, just like Liv has the opportunity to talk to Breck in the story and try to assess how real he is. Breck on my website, the website is steveschaferauthor.com. You can
And do you
go
want to
there. He's,
spell that, the Schaefer?
yeah, it is. Schaefer is Schaefer.
Okay.
steveschaferauthor.com. I appreciate you saying that because, yes, there are about 80 different ways to
Yes,
spell
yeah.
Schaefer. But yeah, you can. Breck is programmed to be on the website just like he is on the in the book. So, readers can try to assess for themselves, like how real is he? And, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, if you really want to swim in the deep end, you can try to convince him that you're real. Because it's not so easy to do, which you get a couple of sentences in and you're like, oh my God, this really is so subjective. It's based on my experiences. So it was just a it's a fun it's been a really fun tool to have along for the ride.
Awesome. Now, when you finished Immortal and were ready to publish it, was it easier finding a publisher the second time around?
It was easier in that I had some credibility for the number of copies that that the border was able to sell, and that essentially ended up being the proving point for a publisher to jump off and go, okay, let's look at this story.
Did you end up with the same publisher or a different
No, I
one?
ended up with a different publisher.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny when you get paired up with a publisher. Your editor really becomes your touch point at that publishing house. And the editor that I was with at my first publishing house didn't embrace the story in the same way that I was. So we just kind of acknowledged that that wasn't the right story for them and went looking elsewhere.
Do you still have the same agent?
I actually do not. My agent has since retired from the business. So yes, my next step in whatever story comes after this will be going back and picking up a partner in crime.
Do you know what you're writing next?
The short answer is no. The long answer is probably way too complicated.
Okay, all right.
I don't know. I don't know if I want to stick with YA or go into maybe an adult story. And I have some neat ideas for both of those. So I just need to make
Awesome.
that decision.
Well, Steve, I want to thank you for joining us today on Writer's Voices. We always end with a quote, which I'm going to pick one from Albert Einstein, who said,
Oh.
"Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one."
That seems like a really appropriate quote to end this conversation
I
on,
think
doesn't
so
it? Yeah, thank you so
too.
much. Thank
Thank
you so much
you.
for having me. I loved it. I love this. This is wonderful.
Oh, thank you, and
Appreciate it.
see you all next week on Writers' Voices.